1 year since Bahrainis took to the streets demanding justice from the Al Khalifa rulers. The movement is still on its feet, although it's not been getting the amount of international attention that other Arab uprisings have attracted. On this edition of News Analysis, we're asking where the Bahraini uprising has come during the past year and what lies ahead for another dictatorial regime facing the wrath of its people.
Inspired by the revolutions in Tunisia and Egypt, a popular uprising began in Bahrain on February 14, 2011. People began demonstrations at Pearl Square in the center of the capital Manama, demanding far-reaching reforms and equality. The demand soon expanded to a call for an end to the monarchy of King Hamad, after a deadly night raid against protesters on February 17th. Police broke up protesters camped out at Pearl Square, killing several and wounding hundreds more. In mid-March, troops and security forces from the neighboring Arab countries arrived in Bahrain at the request of the Manama regime. Their mission? To help crush opposition protests across the kingdom. Since then, their crackdown, directly backed by Saudi Arabia, has been going on unrelented. It's been intensified over the past months as anti-regime protests escalate. Scores have been killed, many of them under torture in prison. Several hundred, including activists, have been detained. Many more have been sacked from their jobs. A number of others face trials for taking part in anti-regime rallies. An independent report in November confirmed that the Bahraini regime used excessive force against protesters. But no major efforts were made by the international community to make the regime stop its brutal crackdown. Neither the United Nations Security Council nor the Arab League met on the worsening situation in Bahrain. This while they held several meetings on the situation in Syria, where they blame an ongoing unrest on Bashar al-Assad's government. They're now mulling on sending troops to Syria. The Arab League has announced political and financial support for the Syrian opposition, saying its members will cut diplomatic ties with Damascus. No matter how long the double standard by the Western-led international community might last, Bahrainis say they will continue their revolution until their demands are met.
Well, joining me now live from London is Mr. Saeed Shahabi with the Bahrain Freedom Movement. Also with us live from Beirut, Sarah Marusik, political analyst. And joining us live from Philadelphia, author and investigative journalist, Mr. David Lindorf. Thank you very much for being with us, everyone. My first question will go to our guest in London, Mr. Saeed Shahabi. 1 year on, where has the revolution come to? Your opening remarks, do let us know.
Thank you very much. I think the revolution has come a long way forward. First of all, it has managed to convince the world that the regime of the Al Khalifa is a torturous regime, is a murderer. This is the product of the BICI, Bahrain Independent Commission of Investigation, that issued its report on the 23rd of November and headed by Sharif Bassiouni. It established clearly that systematic torture was rampant and that the regime was killing its adversaries in an extrajudicial manner. And of course, it had also established that the regime was destroying mosques, more than 53 religious sites. So on one hand, we have managed to convince the world that we are being ruled by a regime that commits international crimes or crimes against humanity. On the other hand, the people have become more clearer in their vision. When they started, they wanted some marginal demands, the reinstatement of the 1973 constitution, and the release of the prisoners, the stopping of the naturalization process, and ending discrimination. Today, the people are saying wholeheartedly for the past several months that we want a regime change. The Al-Khalifa has no place in this country. So I think we have come a long way ahead, especially that also that when we started, we had only a few sectors of the society calling for reform. Today, right. Everybody, the medics, the athletes, the lawyers, the women, the children, everybody is there on the street preparing for the final hour of this regime.
Let's go to Beirut now. Sarah Marusek's opinion on this as well. Sarah, there have obviously been consequences because of this movement, but can we name anything as an achievement for the popular movement? Mr. Saeed Shahabi saying that for one, the people who've been on the streets have proven to the international community that the regime is committing crimes, and now the regime has grown as well. But do you think the regime has been successful in suppressing the movement, because basically we're not seeing the kinds of consequences that we saw maybe in other revolutionary movements in the region?
Well, thank you for having me. I definitely think that the regime has been somewhat successful in at least apparently making rule and order in their authoritarian and draconian and very violent way. And so they have definitely suppressed protests. They have, like your other guest has said, destroyed mosques. And, you know, I find it increasingly ironic how much the regime sounds like the state of Israel and its behavior and its excuses. They say things like, oh, well, these mosques were illegally built. That's exactly what the Israeli says when they destroy Palestinian homes. You know, I think more and more every day we actually see, you know, the Bahraini government behaving like Israel. Unfortunately, I think, you know, I do agree with your other guests that the protesters are more united and they're more determined and they will eventually succeed. However, I just have to, as an American, lament the international community's response and really question why the media has not been able to convey what's been going on the ground. I know that more recently, a lot of journalists have been trying to get into Bahrain for the 1 year anniversary of the beginning of the revolution tomorrow, but they haven't been able to get in. Even Al Jazeera, ridiculously, cannot get in. Al Jazeera English, I'm not sure about the Arabic. Mm-hmm. So we see, you know, again, the New York Times cannot get in. It's absolutely ridiculous that right now there's no media coverage because the Bahraini government refuses to let in any journalists, which just shows that they're not really going to deliver on any of the reforms that the independent report demanded that they must live up to. They must make changes, because right now the Shias in Bahrain are terribly oppressed, and it's not something that's just political, it's also economical, it's also social.
Right.
And if the regime will not let in journalists to see what goes on for the next few days, then it's obvious that they have no intention but to do anything about violence against these, you know, peaceful protesters.
Right. Let's go to David Lindorf now in Philadelphia. David, we heard Sarah Marusek there referring to the international community's role, and that brings the question, could the Bahraini rulers have survived this without the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and their other Arab allies?
Well, I was going to say that actually the elephant in the room is the U.S. Fifth Fleet and CENTCOM, which are based in Bahrain. So the U.S. is looking at this at this point totally from a strategic point of view. They're in a looming confrontation with Iran. The Navy is based there. The Navy is the key factor for the U.S. military in the region, and they're right there in Bahrain. So it was a central staging point for the war on Iraq. It was a central staging point for the war in Afghanistan. And it will be a central staging point for any conflict that might happen with Iran. So from the U.S. point of view, they're going to back Al-Khalifa to the hilt while this is going on. It would be a disaster for U.S. foreign policy and its war-making plans if if the Shia demonstrators were to succeed in winning a victory of, you know, a new parliament and so on. Mm. So the fleet can't be moved at this point. So the U.S. is going to be backing the leadership there. Right. Whether that'll work is another question. I mean, I think that, you know, there's a lot of growing power to the opposition in the streets, and I think time is more on their side.
Yeah, we'll bring that question up in the course of the program. But back to London now, Mr. Shahabi, let's just touch upon the role of Saudi Arabia here as well. When we're looking at Saudi Arabia's role both in Bahrain and now very much increasingly in Syria, we're seeing Saudi troops entering Bahrain to help the Bahraini regime suppress the protests, while in the case of Syria, Saudi Arabia is accused of sending rather terrorists inside Syria to suppress the regime. So Saudi Arabia saying it supports democracy for Syrians, but then suppressing a peaceful movement in Bahrain. So what do you think about the intentions of Saudi Arabia here, and what are those interests, and how far is Saudi Arabia willing to go to safeguard these interests?
We have finished 1 year of revolution in the Arab world. The Arab Spring is 1 year old, and now we are entering a second year. But this second year is the year of the counter-revolution, unfortunately. And the counter-revolutionary forces are headed by Saudi Arabia, of course, the United States, and Britain. They are putting every effort at their disposal to ensure that none of the revolutions does really win. Even in Egypt or in Tunisia, yes, we have the presidents of both countries defeated and overthrown, but the movements which are working for the counter-revolutionary powers are there, and we are still not confident of what's going to happen in those countries. Now, as for the Saudis, I think they have committed a major mistakes by invading Bahrain. Bahrain is under occupation today, and we will continue to resist this occupation. But the Saudis have not been successful in putting down the revolution, because the revolution, despite the international blackout, has been going on in the streets non-stop for the past year. Mm-hmm. Last night, at least 50 demonstrations in all parts of the country took place. And today, thousands of people went to the Paris Square. Now, the Saudis are playing this game of terror and terrorizing a small country and occupying its land. And I think their fate there will not be much different from that of the Soviet Union when it invaded Afghanistan, or when it invaded Hungary in 1956, or when it invaded Czechoslovakia in 1968. So I think the Saudis will be defeated eventually. Now, as for their involvement in Syria, this is ridiculous for the Saudis, or any, for that matter, any of the six GCC countries to claim a moral high ground in terms of democracy. They are the worst regimes in the world, the most reactionary, backward, hereditary dictatorships in the world. There is, you can never find a worse situation than in those countries. Yet they want to champion the cause of democracy on one hand, but they want to also champion the cause of the counter-democracy on the other hand. I think that's not going to work.
And then the basic question here, Sarah Marusik, if I could put that question to you. When we're speaking of the Saudi interests, the U.S. interests, as our guest in Philadelphia there was saying, the U.S. is the fifth fleet in Bahrain. How important that is. We're seeing weapons being provided even for the Bahraini regime that's being used against these protesters. The question is, how far is the U.S. or is Saudi Arabia willing to go in its support? And do you think there is a time when the U.S. and Saudi Arabia will try to force maybe the Bahraini rulers to forego some of their authorities or to give some kind of concession to end or quiet down these protests?
Well, I think, as your other guest pointed out, that the Saudis have learned very well from the Americans how to be the ultimate hypocrites in their behaviors and their actions when it comes to the Middle East. I can't imagine that they would ever willingly pressure the Bahraini regime to open up and to reform in a realistic and an appropriate way that's required by the protesters, because that would basically mean that they would be giving up power. They're not popular. They're oppressive. They're not representative. The majority of the population is currently so marginalized. And like I said, it's not just political. It's also economic and it's also social. And so I don't see the United States or Saudi Arabia really thinking that this would be a good path to go down. I see them supporting the oppression, because there's no way once the genie's out of the bottle, there's no way that the government in Bahrain can exist in its current form. And of course, Saudi Arabia would be so fearful to have a country right there with a popular democratic government, because Saudi Arabia, like your other guest said, is one of the most authoritarian, if not the most authoritarian regime in the entire world. And so why in the world would it promote democracy on its borders when it's scared of that in its own country? And that's why the irony of what's going on in Syria is just overwhelming. It's outrageous that the Saudi regime could be taking such a vocal stand on the issue with Syria when its regime is far worse than anything that goes on in Syria, and it's laughable. But the problem is that the institutions in the Gulf have now become so contaminated with this hypocrisy, this American, Western sort of hegemony, this way of thinking, that all of these institutions are failing the Arab people, and they're not coming in to stabilize these populations that are being oppressed. And you see that in Bahrain today.
Mr. Lindorf, now, our guest, Mr. Shahabi, in London, was telling us at the start of the program of the report that referred to the human rights violations in Bahrain, the torture of detainees, the fact that doctors were detained for treating protesters, and a lot of people who've been sacked, for instance, from their jobs for taking part in anti-regime rallies. So basically, what is the role of human rights organizations, the international community, for instance, the United Nations in this? Do you think that the UN should have and could have interfered here in favor of the Bahraini people? And if it hasn't, where is this going to leave the Bahraini popular movement?
Well, you have two questions there. I mean, I think the role of the human rights organizations, the NGOs and so on, and the organizations within Bahrain are crucial, because they're the ones that really shine a light on the atrocities and oppression by the government of the movement. And so that's where we learn about it, really, particularly since reporters are being blocked from being there from outside the country. But the second question about the UN is that contrary to the belief of our right-wing lunatics in the United States, the UN is basically a tool of the United States, so that it's hamstrung and cannot act as it ought to act, because the U.S. will always act in its own interest and block it at the Security Council, as it has any kinds of actions against Israel. So the UN is kind of, I guess the General Assembly has the ability to air what is happening and to, you know, sort of protest what's happening, but any decisive action by the UN has to be something that the United States supports.
Mr. Shahabi,
that's not going to happen.
Mr. Shahabi, looking at how the maybe United Nations should intervene, how the domestic situation in Bahrain should change in a way that protests would stop. As someone who's been involved in the protest movement and the demands of these protesters, what is basically the solution that these demonstrators in Bahrain are looking for? Is it for the king to give up some of his power? Is it for the king now to essentially go, and for the monarchy system to go? What is it that the people are looking for?
I think the demands have developed over the year. They have not been the same now as they were a year ago. When they started, they were calling for the reinstatement of the 1973 constitution, or the change of the constitution that was imposed on the people 2002. We have to remember that 14th of February was chosen to coincide with the repeal of the only legitimate constitution, and that is of 1973. It was repealed on the 14th of February 2002, and that's why the people chose that day for the revolution. Now, when they started, they wanted that constitution to be back, or they wanted more of constitutional changes. Of course, they wanted other things, like, as I mentioned earlier, a stop to the discrimination and to the political naturalization.
Right.
However, after a year experience, they have now realized that they are living with an enemy, that the Al Khalifa have become the real enemies of the Bahrainis. They are they have brought outside powers. They have given up the sovereignty of the country to them, to the outsiders, and also they have treated Bahrainis in an enmetic way.
Right.
They killed, they maimed, they destroyed, they just attacked, they raped. So all this put together has convinced the Bahrainis that they cannot coexist, they cannot cohabit again with the Al-Khalifa monarchy. It has to go in the same way as that of Mubarak and that of Bin Ali.
Yeah.
So I think at the moment the people are saying that we do not want the Al-Khalifa to remain in
Mr.
power
Shahabi,
anymore.
I'm afraid I've got to stop you because we've run out of time. A big thank you there to Mr. Saeed Shahabi with the Bahrain Freedom Movement in London, Sarah Marusak in Beirut, political analyst and author and investigative journalist. Mr. David Lindorf was with us from Philadelphia. Thank you very much. I'm afraid we've run out of time. From me, Homa Lezgi, and the rest of the team in Tehran, it's goodbye.